Support for Alaska Public Media On Demand comes from Aleut, an Alaska Native regional corporation serving over 5,000 Unangak shareholders and descendants with a mission to provide economic growth. Aleut's portfolio includes government contracting, real estate, technology, and energy. Learn more at aleutcorp.com.
From renaming Alaska's tallest mountain to cutting federal jobs and eliminating millions in grants and contracts, there is no question that the first 100 days of the second Trump administration has had big effects on Alaska. Supporters of the president appreciate the calls for more oil and gas development here, but tariffs are hitting our state particularly hard. We'll discuss what has changed and how Alaskans feel about it after 3 months of Trump's efforts to reshape the economy, business, and culture of our country today on Talk of Alaska.
The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of Alaska Public Media, this station, or its underwriters.
Hello, from Alaska Public Media, it's Talk of Alaska. I'm Lori Townsend. It will take time to understand the full scope of the economic fallout from all of the executive orders, the cuts to federal staffing enacted by the so-called Department of Government Efficiency, or DOGE, and other Trump administration actions that have canceled or frozen funding for infrastructure and renewable energy projects in Alaska. It will also take time to see if one of the president's goals of unleashing Alaska's resource potential will result in more oil and gas development, including the long elusive Alaska Gas Line project. Does hanging the open for business sign on Alaska through executive action mean anything? How does the president's desire to lower the price of oil square with a push to explore in a state known for high development costs? Like most news organizations, our reporters in D.C. and in Alaska have been digging into the flurry of actions that have taken place in the first 100 days. Joining me today to talk about that work is Alaska Public Media's Liz Ruskin in the U.S. Capitol. Hi, Liz.
Hello.
Thanks for being with us. Also with us today is Avery Elfeld. Avery is an Alaska Desk reporter based at KHNS in Haines. Hi, Avery.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Thanks for being with us. And Andrew Kitchenman is in the studio with me today. Andrew is the editor for the Alaska Beacon, and he's based here in Anchorage. Andrew was previously a state government reporter for Alaska Public Media. Andrew, thanks for being in the studio with me, so I'm not here all by myself.
It's good to be here.
It's great to have you. All right, so to get us started today, I want to reference our website, alaskapublic.org. You'll find a story there titled 10 Ways Trump Has Changed Alaska in 100 Days. It features in-depth reporting from journalists who are joining us today. We'll drill down into these topics throughout the hour and hear from Alaskans on how they're thinking about these first few months of the Trump administration. Liz, start us off here. The first thing on this list is lost federal revenue. DOGE has eliminated millions in federal project funds for Alaska. I realize there's still a lot that isn't known about money that may or may not be reinstated, but what is known at this point about how much is lost?
Oh, absolutely nothing. Just to say that, I mean, we know anecdotally, we know of things that were cut, we know of things that were frozen. No one has a really good picture of the total here because of the process, because it was, you know, people looking through the spending and crossing off things, and it wasn't done in a systematic way, so we don't really know. Senator Murkowski, you would think that she would know. She says she's trying to track it. She doesn't want to provide a figure. The 4-Acre Group, which provides services for Alaska nonprofits, they don't know. I did find a guy at a think tank who built a DOGE tracker for the whole country. His answer for Alaska was $70 million. But that is just terminated grants, not contracts, and it's not frozen grants. So we really don't know the amount or the total, but we know that the uncertainty is having its own impact because organizations and governments that operate, you know, utilities and build infrastructure and provide services, they don't know if they can buy equipment, buy supplies, hire summer workers, or if they're going to be unable to get the grant money to pay those bills.
So the floor is $70 million and counting.
Oh, yeah. He said there were, you know, entire sections of the budget that he was just finding out about.
Andrew, jump in here. What does the Beacon's reporting find in this regard, and how much is known about the loss of federal funding for the state budget?
Yeah, unfortunately, as far as providing clarity, I think from the state budget point of view and state reporting point of view, it really is parallel to what Liz just said, which is that mostly we don't know. So, you know, there's no number that you could put on it at this point as far as loss of federal dollars to the state. As an example, the sort of primary example would be that we anticipate, you know, that the largest cut coming from the federal government will be to the Medicaid program. And I think we'll probably get into Medicaid a little bit over the hour. But that hasn't materialized yet. We don't know. There's a lot of different ways that you can cut Medicaid spending. And, you know, Liz is there in Washington where that hasn't been decided yet. That's going to be a massive impact for state government. So the legislature is trying to build in a little bit of room into the budget, but that accounts not just for potentially lost state federal spending, which could be many multiples what they're allowing for, but also lost revenue, which also is connected in some ways to the Trump administration, in that maybe some of the policies they're pursuing may be affecting the price of oil, and that price of oil still really matters. It doesn't matter quite as much as it did 10 years ago or 15 years ago, but it still matters quite a bit in terms of the state budget.
It must be really hard for lawmakers to try to craft a budget when they're not certain. The federal government is a big, federal spending is a big chunk of our annual state budget. And when you don't have clarity, how are they finalizing budgets?
Yeah, I think of the very first Senate majority news conference of this session, our reporter Corinne Smith asked about the potential elimination of the Federal Department of Education. And the answer from Senate President Gary Stevens was that we don't know, that department is a department, but it isn't necessarily the programs within the department that actually provide the funding to the state. And that essentially they have to just not deal with it, not think about it. It's just not, because they don't have information, they're just not going to, you know, try to speculate. Or, I mean, it's been hard reporting wise, because we want to tell Alaskans what this will mean in their lives. And like, we know Medicaid matters quite a bit in Alaskans' lives, but I don't know if it makes sense to do 15 stories about 15 different ways you can cut Medicaid, because it doesn't tell you anything. I mean, in concrete terms.
Right, right. All right. Thank you for that, Andrew. Let's go to the phones for a moment. Terry is in Valdez. Hello.
Yeah, I'm disappointed in the lawmakers in Washington, D.C. that are shirking their responsibility. Tariffs are clearly their responsibility. And to cede this over to Donald Trump is just such a negative. It's killing this country, and it's killing the world economy. They need to take it back and tell Trump he can't be doing this stuff. He's breaking the law. And I'll sign off and listen to your answers.
All right. Thanks for the call, Terry. So let's hear from some Trump voters.
Oh, wait. Can I answer that?
Please do. Yes. Hello, Liz.
Yeah, this is Liz. Yeah, I just wanted to say that I don't think that Congress is going to take that power back. Senator Murkowski has signed on to a bill that would, in essence, you know, have Congress take that power back. She's been an advocate of that. And a vote to do that just failed in the Senate. And in the House, I would think that there is even less support for among Republicans for standing up to President Trump.
When did that vote take place in the Senate?
Flying and lagging. Was it last week?
So a recent vote. And
yeah, it was recently. Right. Yeah.
All right. Well, thanks for the call, Terry. And as you just heard from Liz, Congress is not feeling their oats in that regard right now, and they're not pushing to take that power back. Let's hear from some Trump voters. Nearly 55% of Alaska voters backed Trump in last year's election. About 100 days into his second term, Alaska Desk reporters found these self-identified Trump voters who ranged from hopeful to remorseful.
Well, I voted for Donald Trump, and I'd do it every day if I could. My name is Terrence Pardee. I'm 78 years old. I've lived in Haines for almost 55 years. I've got much more hope for my country now.
Sure.
We were losing it.
Okay.
Anybody that doesn't realize that? This has no idea, apparently. We're headed in the right direction. Leave the guy alone, let him do his job. And anybody else that shoots their mouths off about things being better without him is absolutely crazy.
I'm Peter Olson, Port Ellsworth, Alaska. I was going to vote for Trump, but unfortunately I was away. I didn't make it back in time to vote. So
tell me more about how you're feeling about the first 100 days of Trump's presidency.
Pretty good. I haven't been keeping up on it, but seems like he's getting better, I think. I, for one, can't wait for him to get rid of the tax on the overtime. Hopefully he lives up to that. But yeah, I really like that he's been auditing federal agencies, making sure that we know where our tax dollars are going. I like the tariff system. I think it's a good idea. I mean, it's going to hurt us for a little bit at first, but I mean, it's just like growing pains.
My name is Raymond Urrea. I have more hope. I feel more secure in what we're doing as America as a whole. Number one, we're standing up for ourselves. That's the biggest thing that we weren't doing. You know, we got to get to a place of strength. And I think that we got to that place immediately, within those 100 days, within those few weeks, because he didn't play around. And I may not believe everything that's taking place right now, that he's going to be straight on the narrow, but I know that the direction we're going is the right direction. And I'm really excited about that. I'm glad, more proud than ever again to be an American.
Hector Gomez. I vote for him. I think he do good, but I think he's not right now. He do bad stuff, you know. I don't think he do right. Too many things. Economics so bad right now. Everything is very bad right now for everybody, you know, not for us. I trust him, but, you know, I don't know. We got to give it a couple more days. Let me see what happens.
Such an interesting mix of voices there. Those interviews came from Avery Elfelt, who we'll hear from in a moment. Avery is in Haines. And Alona Nyden in Anchorage. Voices mostly in support. We'll talk some about poll numbers later on. But Liz, I want to go back to you quickly here. Beyond direct funding for projects, describe what your reporting found related to federal job loss.
Well, again, we know very little about the numbers. I profiled one fellow, a federal biologist. He took one of the fork in the road offers of early retirement. And in response to that story, I heard anecdotally of dozens of senior employees at many agencies, people with institutional knowledge and skills that they're leaving. I think it's having a huge impact on Alaska households, of course, and communities, but it's largely invisible in part because we just can't quantify it yet. And as I reported this story, one of the factors I noticed that is keeping it invisible is that everybody who took the early retirement is on administrative leave until the end of the year. So they still have a lot on the line. It's hard for them to come forward, to talk frankly, because they still worry about retaliation even after their last day at the office. And for example, the probationary employees who were fired and rehired. And I mean, I think that even if they are at this point not receiving paychecks anymore, I've talked to some of them and they're afraid to come forward because they think, listen, this might scotch my chances of being rehired at some point.
Mm. Andrew, I saw you nodding your head in agreement there a minute ago. What has your reporting found in this respect? It's going to be a while before we really know the final numbers of job loss, correct?
Yeah, I've been looking at Alaska's monthly employment report, the statistics, and I was really curious what the March report would say because it seemed like we were getting a lot of news in March. And federal employment in Alaska went up by 100 people in March, which just shows that whatever is happening is not showing up in the concrete statistics yet.
Interesting.
Well, also because the people who have, you know, taken the fork in the road offers from DOGE, they are, I believe, still counted as employees because they're on admin leave until the end of the year. So I don't know when they would start showing up is no longer a federal position, but I think they've got a federal position now.
Yeah, that would make sense to me, too, that they would still show up because they're on leave, but they're still being paid, correct? And
right.
Some of them are out in September, is that right?
Yeah, as I understand it, if you were eligible for the early retirement, then you are on until the end of the year. If you were just taking the offer to leave, then you're sometime in September, maybe it was early September, you stop getting a paycheck. So I think it'll be a long time until these jobs disappear from the federal payroll.
All right, let's get Avery in here now. Thanks for your patience, Avery. Another issue of concern is Alaska's relationship with our Canadian neighbors. Avery, you spoke with the premier of Yukon Canada, which borders Skagway and Haines. Tell us what the premier had to say about tariffs and the president's desire to make Canada, the country, a state.
Yeah, so we chatted about all of this, the tariffs, the annexation threats, and kind of what it all means for not only the like economics of the region and country more broadly, but also kind of, you know, this really important kind of cross-border relationship that's existed for so long. So he kind of spoke about this growing movement in Canada, you know, among folks to avoid visiting the U.S. or spending money here. And he really acknowledged that, you know, Canadians are facing what he called a deeply personal choice in that regard, and says he and, you know, the Yukon government have really avoided advising on that choice. But even though, you know, some folks are deciding, you know, not to come visit for the summer or for some upcoming events, he says it really seems there's kind of a keen awareness of the importance of the relationship between Canada and Alaska, and specifically the Yukon and Haines and Skagway. And for the most part, really don't blame Alaskans. Here's what he had to say.
We never lose sight of that in the Yukon, understanding how deep the connections are. I think that we are very clear on the fact that the challenges are being brought on our country and our territory by the Trump administration. This is not about the people of Alaska or the communities that you serve.
Thanks, Avery. He was trying to really kind of parse it out there and make it sound as if it's not you, people of Alaska, that we're most concerned about. Tariffs are also very much on the minds of Alaskans and our Canadian neighbors. Tariffs and annexation talk have affected tourism. Tell us about how that is hitting Skagway and Haines, Avery.
Yeah, so I'd say it's still almost a little early to say for certain, just because we're kind of coming up on the summer season, and that'll kind of bring a little clarity around, you know, how strong this sort of boycott effort is here. But I do think one of the main concerns locally has been around tourism, just given how many folks from the Yukon specifically come to visit Haines and Skagway on long weekends and for kind of, you know, athletic events and other types of festivals. Yeah, so you know, businesses have also raised some concern. And when I was headed out to chat with folks about the first 100 days of the Trump administration, I met a long-term Haines resident named Kenneth Gross. He runs a salmon fishing and wildlife cruise charter company out of Skagway, though he lives in Haines. And he said usually around this type of time of year, he gets, you know, more than 10 booking inquiries a day, whether that's via email or phone calls, but he's currently only getting a few a week. And he's also had three different groups of Canadian customers cancel their tours altogether. Here's what he said about that.
And they're very nice and they're very apologetic, but they canceled their whole cruise. They didn't even get a refund because they're being unified in Canada. And you know, it wasn't just the tariffs. I'm sure it was the threat of being annexed and all that stuff that really made them not very happy.
They were very nice, very apologetic. Avery, only a few inquiries a week, that must ripple out to other businesses that depend on tourism. What else are you hearing from local businesses about how they're planning for this summer season? Are they cutting back on supplies or have they figured that out yet?
I think a lot of folks are still figuring it out, and it sort of, again, seems like a wait and see. You know, there are definitely other anecdotal accounts kind of around town of Canadians already kind of communicating that they won't be coming or that they're kind of trying to distance. A local gift shop owner, for instance, had a Canadian artist pull all of their work from their store. And our tourism director here in Haines has reported fewer visitors and receiving kind of emails from Canadians basically saying we won't be coming for the time being. That's actually been so prevalent that the borough has shifted some of its tourism marketing from Canada to the Western U.S. because it, you know, started to feel like that marketing wasn't that money wasn't being well spent because some Canadians are pretty insistent that they're not going to come. You know, otherwise, we've kind of seen some, you know, early numbers around different upcoming events that make it seem like we might see fewer Canadians. And so that's something, you know, there's a triathlon coming up and a bike race and a beer fest, and folks are kind of, you know, trying to adjust for that. But I think no one really wants to make big moves too soon because it's, you know, still early for some of those. Yeah. So again, I think people are just kind of waiting to see. At the same time, you know, there are some factors that complicate the picture. For instance, the Chilkat Valley News reported recently that local border crossings at the border outside of Haines were actually up in March compared to the last few years.
Huh.
And when I reported on a ski race in Skagway in March that usually draws lots of Canadians, you know, numbers were pretty typical compared to recent years. And I spoke with plenty of folks who were, you know, really, really angry about everything going on, but said they really, you know, weren't going to let it keep them from attending their favorite annual event.
Really interesting that there's some pockets of real angst, an artist pulling their work out of a store, a Canadian artist. That's really an extreme reaction. And then other folks saying, yeah, we're kind of mad, but we're still going to come and visit you. So what a wide range.
Yeah, it seems like there's just kind of this fondness right here for the whole region. So some folks, and lots of folks will say, I'm making this decision not to come, but it breaks my heart. It kind of seems like the common sentiment is even if folks decide not to come, they're not, you know, happy about that decision.
Andrew, how are Alaska lawmakers responding? The Senate passed a resolution supporting Canada. Was that yesterday?
It was
recently.
Yeah, we were on top of that. And then there was some additional news yesterday and we had to adjust our focus. But that's been pretty strong throughout the session, the sense that lawmakers want to maintain a positive relationship, positive ties, economic, otherwise, with Canada. And that's been a definite through line. Regarding the tariffs, one area where they're definitely eyeing that potential impact is seafood. where a lot of our seafood is, a lot of Alaska's seafood is processed in China, and definite concern there. But I mean, the seafood industry was also was already facing so many huge problems, and that's something that, as the legislature considers the Alaska Seafood Marketing Institute budget, it's difficult because it really wanted to have a big increase last year, and the governor vetoed that increase because the ASME didn't have a plan in place that the governor was looking for. Now the governor is looking for an increase, but the state budget is so tight, and also perhaps a moment in terms of marketing internationally may have passed.
Yeah. All right, we will talk more about seafood tariffs and how the executive actions are affecting Alaska, both in good ways and ways that are challenging some folks. We have on the line with us today Liz Ruskin, Alaska Public Media's Washington, D.C. reporter. Avery Elfeld is an Alaska Public Media Alaska Desk reporter based in Haines and is on the line with us. And in the studio with me today is Andrew Kitchenman. Andrew is the Alaska Beacon editor and a former Alaska Public Radio state government reporter. We will be back after this break as Talk of Alaska continues statewide. Welcome back to Talk of Alaska. We're discussing the first 100 days of the Trump administration. We are hearing some Alaskan voices. Let's hear some more. Reporters with the Alaska Desk asked regular people around the state if their lives have been directly affected by Trump's first 100 days. We'll hear first from a man named Kurt Meacham.
I'm probably the smallest business owner in Alaska. I am the owner in Chalkeetna of one cabin that they're renting for the summer is probably down 70, maybe 80%, all due to Trump and the indecision in our economy. Because nobody wants to come to Alaska because they're terrified of, they come up here, is Denali going to be open? Do you know that the Menihau Glacier going to be open? Is Alaska accessible? Let alone the people that are scared to drive through Canada because of Trump and the anti-American resentment. So I'm terrified.
I'm Ellie Birnbaum. I'm 28. Right now I'm here in Fairbanks, Alaska, working for the National Ecological Observatory Network. We do work that is funded by the NSF, the National Science Foundation, and I think there's some uncertainty about how long that funding will last. Also say, like, I planned on going to grad school soon, and it would be in STEM and climate-focused studies, and that will probably be put off because of funding issues.
Walter Lord. Well, I was trying to invest in the stock market. I was doing pretty good, and I went back about $3,000, but I don't have a whole lot in there, less than $10,000, but it dropped about $3,000.
It's Vicky McDonald, spelled just like the restaurant.
Has your life changed at all in the last 100 days?
For me personally, no, I haven't really experienced a lot of changes for myself. Work standpoint, with tariffs coming into effect soon, we have seen where our warehouse is trying to purchase up things, things like the bicycles, for example, that we know are going to get hit hard with tariffs. We're buying as many as we can now and warehousing them, so we won't have to impact the customers by raising the prices right away for the things they're going to want here really soon with summer coming up. But personally, I haven't experienced any changes.
Those interviews came from Alaska Desk reporters Alona Naden in Anchorage, Shelby Herbert in Delta Junction, and Theo Greenlee in Sandpoint. Andrew, you were talking about tariffs before the break there. What has the Beacon's reporting found related to the effect generally on prices here? Is that somewhat clarifying yet?
Well, I mean, I don't think our prices are going to be radically different than the rest of the country. So you know, there's just a lot of uncertainty, you know, that just in the last couple of days, we're starting to learn how much the decrease in shipments from China that started a month ago are happening on the West Coast. And, you know, if there's a shortage of goods throughout the rest of the year, then that would tend to cause inflationary pressure. It's just that I think there's a lot of uncertainty. I mean, it's been interesting watching the stock market where it went down when the president named announced the tariffs, and now it's back up to where it was before he made that announcement, which just shows how unpredictable things are. You know, that person who just spoke about losing $3,000, I don't know if he took money out of the market, but, you know, there's a chance if he was invested broadly that if he had just left it in the market, he'd be back to where he was a month ago.
And so seafood concerns. Competition from cheaper Russian seafood imports was hurting the price for Alaska's seafood. Could the tariffs help American seafood in this respect or make it worse?
Well, I think I don't have a, we haven't heard a lot of people being pleased at the prospect of the seafood. I think having tariffs on Russian seafood could be helpful, but the issue with the Russian seafood is the rest of the world. You know, if the rest of the world is buying Russian seafood, that it's a global market, and that's where the competition problem occurs. So you know, our ability to put tariffs on that doesn't really help in terms of the global competition.
All right, let's go back to the phones for a moment. Tom is in Juneau. Hello, Tom.
Yes, good morning. Thanks for calling me back. I just wanted to say, and by the way, I first moved to Alaska over 50 years ago. I've spoken to quite a few Alaskans and asked them if, and I voted for President Trump, I've asked them if they know any Alaskan who voted for President Trump in last November and now wishes they instead had voted for the Harris-Walz ticket. And I've yet to have anybody tell me they know a single Alaskan who says, yes, if they had it to do over, they'd vote for Harris-Walz. You know, I'm not an economist. I'm kind of a lifelong student of economics in a way, but I just wanted to get in because I don't want to take your whole show or something. I wanted to say a primary issue for me is the Second Amendment, and I know a lot of Alaskans feel the same way. And you know, it's a weight off my shoulders that now with President Trump compared with President Biden, we don't have the White House haranguing us every day and trying to find a way to get the alcohol, tobacco, and firearms people to have a SWAT team come visit law-abiding gun owners. And we don't have the White House thinking of ways to restrict this gun or that gun or anything. President Trump has made good in his 100 days he's helped out gun law-abiding gun owners. And to me, that alone is of primary importance to Alaskans. You know, I do watch equity markets and fixed income markets some, you know, I've been following the oil market in the last few days and the prospects and whatnot, but you know, I expect market volatility, and I expected some president would try to fix or at least stem the federal deficit. And that's going to impact the economy negatively if we try to start spending within our means. We have been overspending, and that's got to stop at some point. And so no matter who is in the White House, if we try to rein in spending so that we might one day have a balanced budget, then certainly that's going to be a dampening on the economy. And that's all I'll say.
All right.
I don't want to take so much time.
Thank you, Tom, for the call. Liz, I want to turn to you now, kind of following up here. The president says he wants to unleash Alaska's resource potential, including more oil and gas. Yet he also wants to bring down the price of oil to help Americans with fuel costs. Those two things don't seem to square for Alaska. What did your reporting find in that regard?
Well, they are not compatible. If you bring down the price of oil, it means that Alaska projects don't pencil out as well. But I think the administration's goal is to clear all the administrative hurdles, all the environmental restrictions that the Biden administration imposed on Alaska projects, and then hope that helps the economics of the project. Or they're speaking to different constituencies when they say they want lower prices at the pump, and more production domestically. Mm-hmm. I want to say something about what Tom just said about Trump supporters, and I believe he is right that, you know, if you ask most of Alaska's Trump voters, how do you feel, they would say, great. You know, I think that speaks really to our, you know, our polarized politics. Once you have voted for and, you know, gone in for a polarizing figure such as Trump, you are not going to say, you're not going to give that up easily. You're not going to say, oh, I was wrong. I mean, no one likes to do that. They're going to give him a chance. I think that Tom in Juneau is probably right about that. I wonder, you know, why he felt that he was harassed every single day by the previous presidents and their ATF about gun owners. I mean, I don't know that there was daily harassment, how he actually felt daily harassment of that. And now that harassment is gone. I think it's more that it speaks to the cultural changes, that people vote with the culture that they want to see. And I think that that's a lot at play here.
All right, let's go back to the phones for a moment. James is in Anchorage. Hello, James.
Hello. My first comment is when Trump was in his first term, he was leaving the White House, going to get on a helicopter or plane, go somewhere. And a reporter was asking him about a situation that he was, had done. And she says, this is going to create chaos. And he says, I like chaos. And there you go. That's how he functions. He likes chaos. He's got the government in chaos. He's got it where he wants it. Everybody's upset. Everybody's off balance. He loves that. When he was a businessman, he was a great businessman. He used bankruptcy as a tool to avoid business failures and paying his creditors. He's done it more than one time. So this is what America's got to look forward to, is a bankrupt government, and the whole economy of the world is going to be affected by that. So that's basically my take on what he's doing. It's a sorry state of affairs to see what he's doing to humans that are working in the government. They get rawhided out of their jobs. Like, they didn't matter. They were cattle. Brought them through the slaughterhouse. And that's about it. I got a lot more to say, but that covers the majority of my thinking.
All right. Thank you, James, for the call. We had an email from Larry saying, how Donald Trump described himself in his book, The Art of the Deal, told me he thinks of himself as a consummate dealmaker and is not ashamed of his willingness to take advantage of those less informed or weaker than himself. And Larry asks, is that a good thing in a country's leader? Andrew, the president told NBC's Kristen Welker that he's made 200 trade deals. There is a trade deal being hammered out between the UK and India, but to your knowledge, has Trump announced any deals between the US and other nations to lower tariff rates?
Yeah, it was an interesting statement to try to interpret. I mean, my first thought was, well, they announced tariff rates on 200 countries, and so that's an action that's been taken, and you know, the word deal for most people implies
both sides negotiate. Yes.
But I don't know if the president necessarily, you know, when he used the word in that way, was defining a deal as a two-sided arrangement.
All right. We are going to take another quick break. When we come back, we'll continue our discussion about the first 100 days of the Trump administration as Talk of Alaska continues. Welcome back to Talk of Alaska. We're discussing the first 100 days of the Trump administration. By email, David writes, David from Fairbanks here, since Trump came into office, I've seen an alarming increase in harassment and threats of violence toward the LGBTQ community, including at my place of employment. This also affects the mental health of LGBTQ people and even more for queer Alaska Native people as resources for mental health programs are cut. David writes, I worry we are on the precipice of more self-harm and higher suicide rates. Is there any movement at the state level to address LGBTQ issues or mental health treatment? Thank you for the email and the question, David. I don't know that we have the answer for you right here today, but I want to get back to some of what you've been reporting on, Liz. You were reporting on House Republicans working to streamline oil and mining development in a budget reconciliation bill. Is there, do you think there are enough incentives in the bill to overcome the hurdle of low oil prices?
Well, it's not so much a question of the bill. The bill is enormous. This is the reconciliation bill. Reconciliation is a tool that you can get just about anything through as long as it deals with money, and you can get it through the Senate on a simple majority vote. It's not subject to filibuster. So basically, it's kind of a way to fast track a bill. And it has a lot of Alaska projects in it. And it doesn't so much incentivize them. It mandates oil and lease sales. It grants the road corridor for the Ambler Road. Mostly it reimposes the agency approvals from the first Trump administration. And it says these projects are deemed to comply with environmental laws, which I've never seen before, that they just say up front, we've already decided that these projects do comply with all the environmental laws in the bill. I mean, that's an interesting thing for Congress to say. And at least in the case of drilling in the Arctic Refuge, it says the only people who can go to court to sue over this are the leaseholders who, you know, have leases to drill in the Arctic Refuge and the state of Alaska. It is a very interesting bill, and this is just the natural resource section, which is I was just following it in the U.S. House Natural Resources Committee, and they kind of name-checked Alaska an awful lot. They're really looking at Alaska as paying some of the bills for this, and this is the bill that will do all these other things in the government outside of this committee's jurisdiction, but this is where the Medicaid cuts might come in if they're going to happen. And so we're waiting to see what happens with that. It seems like they are just dealing here with the administrative and environmental hurdles, trying to knock those down for a bunch of Alaska projects. And I don't think they are focused on what the price of oil is going to be.
You know, I just want to follow up here on David's concern over LGBTQ Alaskans. We also saw that the Supreme Court just upheld Trump's ban on transgender military service members. So that's another area of concern for the trans community. And hopefully there won't be a backlash there, as David has witnessed in Fairbanks. Liz and Andrew, Alaska political leaders have long desired building a gas line from the North Slope to Kenai for export and to help Alaskans access a stable energy supply. President Trump has spoken in favor of it. The governor has visited Asian countries to drum up support, and a summit is happening in Alaska in June. Is the state truly closer to getting a gas line built, or is this more hype than substance? Andrew, start us off.
You know, that's a difficult question, Laurie. I think that the fact is that over the decades, there have been many moments where there was some sign of progress you could point to. And if having a Trump administration was going to make it happen, it is the case that we've had a Trump administration before, and it did not. So I think, you know, if it happens, it will be in the face of all of the things that have prevented it from happening before now. So it makes it hard. You know, one thing that would be helpful would be a long-term forecast of higher prices, and gas prices are pretty unpredictable and kind of boom and bust, and that's part of the problem is that you know, to make a sustained investment, a sustained commitment, it'll be hard. I think that, for instance, there was some positive signals out of Japan, but then there's like two huge industrial combines in Japan that it would be favorable if they were both on board with it, and one made some sort of mild statements that were maybe mildly positive, but the other did not. And that was like a sign of one thing that had not changed.
Liz, what are your thoughts here? Does it come down to show us the money if you're really interested in building this line, Mr. President?
Yeah, I think the administration is able to get attention, interest on our gas line project or our stranded gas, however you want to put it. And that would be necessary if we're going to get investment in the project, but is it sufficient? I don't think that there is, you know, much that the administration can do to, you know, get investment if it's not economic. It's just going to have to pencil out for these countries to want that gas from Alaska at those prices.
All right. Thank you for that. Avery, I want to get back to you. We downsizing government. We talked earlier about federal job loss. You spoke with a Haynes man who gave a mixed review of the administration's vast, fast, and intense efforts to shrink the size of governments. What did you hear?
Yeah, so I caught up with Kyle Canfield at a local coffee shop here in Haynes last week. He had just gotten there after returning to town from his job. He works at Greens Creek Mine, closer to Juneau. Canfield didn't feel comfortable sharing who he voted for, but he said, you know, on the whole, he agrees with Trump's approach to economic issues and federal spending, and, you know, made the case that there's immense waste in the federal government. But he added a caveat. He thinks, you know, Trump has taken what he called a hatchet approach to a range of issues. And he thought that might have consequences in the near term. Here's Kyle.
I've got an issue with the fact that we've made a lot of cuts, but in the results, a lot of people who were necessary in these hatchet solutions have lost their jobs.
It's interesting to hear people say there's immense waste in government without citing any evidence and then being unhappy with the cuts. Did anyone you've spoken with talk about what kind of waste they believe is happening?
So Canfield specifically cited what he called astronomical waste in the military. He kind of cited anecdotal evidence from friends or other people he knows in the service who have complained about it. And he didn't think that necessarily had to do with the overarching structure of the military, but more with its relationship to the private sector, I would imagine through contracting. He was the main person I spoke with about this. You know, we heard from a man named Terrence Pardee earlier, also a Haynes resident, and he was a pretty just firm supporter of Trump and Elon Musk's effort to downsize the government. He said Musk has done a great job, but really didn't elaborate much beyond that.
All right. Thanks, Avery. Liz, turning back to you here, we only have a few minutes left. Polls can't tell us everything, but the president's approval rating has dropped. A poll published by The Washington Post and ABC News found only 39% of Americans approve of how Trump is conducting his presidency. About 64% of respondents said he was going too far in his efforts to expand presidential powers. Do you think this will matter to Republicans in Congress?
I don't think it will matter, particularly in the House. Those are districts that are where Republicans are elected. They are heavily Republican districts. I think that, you know, when you like a president and you vote for a president, you're not going to abandon him easily. I don't think it matters in the House. In the Senate, yeah, it might cause some wavering. It might cause some senators who have doubts about the direction that's going on. They, you know, they might, you know, break out of the fold a little bit on one vote or another. But I think by and large, his poll numbers would have to drop much more for it to have an impact on how lawmakers in Congress vote, how they act.
And I imagine they're looking for any sort of consistency, too, between polls. As we know, polls can have very, very different results, and I suppose they're watching over time as well. Andrew, one of the Beacon reporters is looking into support centers for Alaska children who have suffered abuse. What can you tell us about the budget struggle around this particular issue?
Oh, that is ongoing. The House included additional funding, and these are the centers that essentially abused children are able to go to and have interviews where it's a supportive atmosphere. And the House added, the Alaska House added money for that program, but the Senate's basically taking out all new spending because of the deficit in the state budget. And so that's where that is.
And so do we know, does this mean closure for these centers? Or is that not clear yet?
We're going to have to do more reporting.
All right. Thank you for that. I want to turn back to our email here. We had an email from Linda who writes, on the Trump discussion first 100 days, I used to check on my elderly neighbors, shovel their walks, and take them food. Now they no longer wish to engage for reasons you can imagine. Meals on Wheels recently started delivering to them as they have no local family. My empathy is gone. She writes, I hate that Trump has changed me, and I hope he doesn't change others. So for the, Andrew, just kind of wrapping up here, many of the policies from the Trump administration are problematic for the state budget. Talk about what has happened to the state deficit since Trump was elected and what the future may hold in that regard.
I mean, the way it's shown up so far is to the extent to which his policies have affected the price of oil, and there's many things that go into the price of oil, that's opened up. Price of oil is running a couple dollars lower than what was forecast even in March. And so, I say running, that's where it was like yesterday. And so, you know, it does vary. They're looking forward. I mean, the biggest potential cut is to Medicaid. I was reading a New York Times story this morning where one potential way to save Medicaid money, Alaska would be the only state in the country that would not be hurt by, and that would actually take care of most of the federal cut to Medicaid. You know, if they do that, then Alaska doesn't see the cost. That's just odd, but that was something I picked up today.
All right. Thank you so much to our guest today, Liz Ruskin, Alaska Public Media's Capital Washington reporter, Avery Elfeld, Alaska Public Media Alaska Desk reporter, and Andrew Kitchenman, Alaska Beacon editor. Thanks to our engineering team, Chris Hyde, our producer, Madeline Rose, our editor, Annie Feit, and on the phones, Wesley Early helped us out today. And I'm Lori Townsend. Thanks for listening. We'll be back next week.
Talk of Alaska is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the participants and not necessarily those of Alaska Public Media, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. This is Alaska Public Media.